Summer is ending, folks, so it's the perfect time for a summer festival. So if you got a yukata lying around, put it on and head off for some fireworks, sweets, and general good times with your friends. And watch out for the ghosts. Or you could just curl up on the sofa and listen with us as Peekaboo Podcast, a fan cast for Pokemon, will today be covering episode 20, The Ghost at Maiden's Peak. To just get this out of the way, this is a heavily edited episode in terms of kanji in the background and, you know, cultural references, things of that nature. And rather than just point out every time there is one, we'll just let you know that there's a lot. It's all background stuff, though, nothing to really affect the plot. And I've always been a little bit middle of the road when it comes to the editing and the censorship alterations, but this is an episode that kind of pulls me in two directions with it, because, like, on the one hand, they edited out, like, every line of kanji in this episode, like, and cultural references, like, Japan, where did you go? And little kids are smarter than adults think they are, and willing to accept things that adults often overthink, but then again, this is only episode 20 in the first series at a time when anime was just breaking into the mainstream market, and Pokemon is a really tough concept to pitch when you think about it. Even now that it's been around for a while, it's still kind of difficult to try to break it down and sell it to somebody who'd never heard of it before. From the standpoint of a company that wants, that makes television shows and wants their audience to like it and be able to relate to it, because if they don't, you know, they're going to go bankrupt, I really get that. Pokemon, this first season, was a risk, and how could anyone know that it would pay off so well? Like, the Japanese creators didn't even expect this thing to run for so long. And kids are smart, but if they get frustrated with something, that's it. They're done. And more than that, the kids might be the ones watching the show for fun, but the parents are the ones deciding whether or not they can. Like, whether they can watch TV, buying the DVDs, etc. So you have to win them over, too. And I've watched people around me, because I'm into a lot of foreign films, and sometimes they just don't like not being able to understand the cultural subtext. And that's fine, because there's a lot of different cultures, just within the United States even, let alone the world. There's not a lot of people who can really be culturally affluent in every culture on Earth. And the world was a whole lot less global in the 90s to boot. So, and you know, Japan and most other countries, they do the same sorts of things when they import a show, because if they want the new audience to like it and relate to it, changing the languages or adapting a reference is part of how they do that. And it's why the series now has adapted the written language of the Pokemon world to stop being kanji and to be more ambiguous symbols. Because the show realizes it's gone global, and, you know, all of this translating and adaptations, they come with that. So I have more of a problem with the show trying to pull something like this massive editing thing now, after, you know, it's been around for a decade, and Japanese culture and media is just a little bit more part of our collective consciousness. So I'm willing to give them a free pass here at episode 20, even though it kind of grates at you, doesn't it? I feel like a dub adaptation should make the series richer, not take things away from it. But anyway, back to the real point. We open up the show with a statue on the seaside. It's a beautiful maiden, and the statue has a ghost that entreats, "Return, I'm waiting." And if you're a fan of the Slayers series, because, wow, that takes me back, the statue here is pretty much identical to the one featured around the beginning of that anime, and it could be a coincidence, but it might be intentional, as both shows did air on TV Tokyo, and Pokemon began only about a year or so after Slayers finished, I believe. Right before the title sequence, we realize that the ghost is actually a Ghastly! And this is cool, because like a few episodes before it, it furthers the idea that some Pokemon with psychic abilities can learn human speech and be able to speak through telepathy. Not all can. There's a lot of Ghastly that can only speak their name. But just like Meowth learned to speak human, other Pokemon can as well, and maybe psychic Pokemon or ghostly Pokemon have a bit of a predisposition to this. It might be easier for them because of their psychic abilities to not have to use their mouths to talk. Back with Team Satoshi, their ship has finally come in. They are headed for land. Brock takes the opportunity to angst about how he wasted the whole summer. Ash doesn't get it, and it's a really interesting look at Ash and Brock since they both left home at about the same time, but have completely different views on what went down this summer. Both left hoping to see the big wide world, chase their dreams, you know, it's the first summer away from home, etc. Ash is 10, and as Brock puts it, thinks of summer as playtime on the beach, and he's right. Ash wants fun, adventure, times with his friends, that's what he left home for. And Brock also wanted all of those things, but I think he was also hoping that if he got out of babysitting duty in Pewter, he would meet chicks. To him, summer is all about girls, and he's bummed that he can't get a summer romance on this journey. It kind of brings up the question of, you know, well, if you want all these mature experiences, why are you hanging out with 10-year-olds? And I think it's kind of a starting point that will eventually end with Brock's line at the end of Sinnoh Region that he needs to grow up and stop being a kid if he wants to achieve his goal of being a Pokemon doctor. And as much as I hate to see him go, I had to say it's about time. Hanging out with the little kids did hold him back in a lot of ways. But then again, it's also improved him invaluably. And it's probably because he realizes that there's some pretty good reasons why he's traveling with them and hasn't joined some older trainers or gone solo. And also catching my interest is that he's never brought those reasons up. If anything, he's moping like he is in this scene, or he's like Misty acting out he's somehow obligated to follow the group around. Brock never really voices why he's decided to travel with Ash despite, you know, the ups and downs and obvious disadvantages there might be with this, or what, you know, being with Ash and Misty means to him. Actually, until Dent came out in issue and said that his ability to empathize with Pokemon, that's what we love about Satoshi, and that's one of the reasons why we're traveling with him. Before that, I don't think any of the characters have ever said plainly what it is that makes them want to travel with Ash. It's kind of something that you observe, but it interests me how Brock and Misty travel with Ash for so many seasons. Misty purposefully doesn't say anything explicit right until the end, and Brock never touches on it at all. And Ash does, from time to time, say why he likes traveling with his current posse. Even so, these three are a group that just ran into each other and stuck together. They don't talk about their relationship to themselves or to other people. Bikini season might be over, but the summer festival is still going on, getting ready to make the transition into autumn. This doesn't cheer Brock up right away, but he does see a girl on the docks, a total knockout. However, before he can get a good look at her, or realize that it's a Ghastly, she's gone. Pikachu also sees her, and seems to be fascinated as well as thinking that something's up. And Pokemon are a bit more in tune with stuff than humans are, that's been proven several times in this series. But Ash and Misty are keen on the festivities, and drag Brock off. With one last look at the dock, Pikachu follows. Team Rocket is trying to get in on festival action as well, specifically the money pilfering side, but James also sees the girl on the dock and proves that he's not completely gay by falling for her. But like Brock, he looks away for a moment and she's gone. But it seems our boys can't get her out of their minds because Brock mopes his way around the festival, commenting that she's the most beautiful girl he's ever seen. And just to point out the background, Ash and Misty look like they're having a good time together, don't they? Aww. The laughter and the angst are both broken up by an old woman who might actually be shorter than Pikachu, who warns Brock about a beautiful young woman who will bring him harm. Misty wishfully thinks it's her, but the old lady repeats that it's a beautiful young woman, not a scrawny blabbermouth, and Ash doesn't know when to keep his mouth shut, so much for the potential poke-shipping scene. The old woman goes on to deliver the same message to James, who doesn't take it seriously because women are always causing him trouble, apparently. Jesse gets suspicious as to what he's implying, but Officer Jenny shows up with the words no criminal wants to hear, "I know exactly what you're all doing." So, Rockets don't get to keep their sought-after penny. One of the events at this festival is an unveiling of a painting done by a monk depicting the legend of the statue we saw at the opening. It seems rather evocative, and Ash and Misty are impressed by the portrait of the girl. Brock and James, however, immediately identify her as the girl on the dock, and are not deterred by the fact that she died like 2,000 years ago. As the story goes, a long time ago there was this war, and her lover sailed off to fight. The woman waited on the shore for him, but he never returned. The boys, of course, just have to see this statue of the girl for themselves, and Brock declares it's the most beautiful rock he's ever seen. And I guess Brock would be the authority. He's spent a lot of his life looking at rocks. Both Brock and James make manly declarations about how they'd protect this girl if she were their girlfriend, never leave her alone, etc., etc. Jesse points out the obvious that James has gone completely insane. But it's kind of cool that he says he'd be willing to fight against Team Rocket to keep her safe. Yeah, I'm never quite sure what James is in this whole evil business for, but he'd go straight for a pretty girl. Wait, that came out wrong. But Jesse and Meowth cook up a plan to steal the painting, because works of art are valuable and they need money. Ash and Misty aren't sure what to do with Brock, as he's insistent on just sitting around staring at the statue. Eventually they leave, and Brock promises to be back by curfew. And it's kind of neat, this Pokemon Center has a curfew. Like, some of them seem to be open 24 hours, bed, breakfast, the whole bit, but this one seems to go by slightly different rules. Possibly because the Joy who runs it is a total busybody. As long as you're under her roof, man, yikes. No late nights allowed, so going after Brock is just gonna have to wait. And it's too bad, because the ghost appears in front of Brock and James and lures them to the cliffside. By the time dawn rises and Nurse Joy lets them go out and look for their missing friend, he's nowhere to be found. Team Rocket are looking for James, and when they find the twerps, Ash and Jesse start off with their usual playground-style flirting. I was half expecting one of them to accuse the other of having cooties. But when it's revealed that James has gone too old, feuds are put aside so Jesse can attempt to do the motto without James. And wow, she gets a point for trying. And James, I guess, takes pity on her and joins in midway, though no one's quite sure where the disembodied voice is coming from. At the end, both he and Brock are ejected from the temple where the painting was and act, well, like they've lost their minds. The short, old woman from before shows up to tell us that they've seen the ghost of the maiden, and I don't know what that girl did to them, but it must have been intense, and I think they probably liked it. Ash has Pikachu shock the two out of their possessive state, which seems to bring them back to their usual selves, not that there's a whole lot of improvement with some of them being free spirits that they are. Now, the next scene, the old lady gives the rundown on how the ghost leads away young men, yada yada yada, but the really important thing here is that Ash is without his hat. This is partially a practical reason, as it might maybe be rude for him to be wearing it inside the temple, but that's a bit weak since he still has his shoes on. But Ash losing his hat serves a much greater purpose after all, because taking off the hat opens up his face. It's a simple costuming thing, and it always amazes me that it can make such a difference in an animated show, because the hat won't hide his eyes or cast a shadow if the animators don't want it to. They can film Ash from any angle they want. But it does, it really does. When he takes off his hat, I feel his eyes are more accessible, and, you know, the eyes are the windows to the soul, they say. It's why Disney usually animates their eyes quite large, which led to Osamu Tezuka doing the same thing, which is why anime eyes have become so iconic for being on the large side. And when you can see them clearly, you can convey so much more emotion and information. It's why we like people looking us in the eye when we talk to them. And so when Ash does take off his hat, or turns it backwards, or any alternate costumes, really, it's fascinating to look at what's going on in the scene, because sometimes it's a practical thing, like they're swimming or something, and sometimes it has a specific purpose to it. And here, with a ghost story and they're giving out all the dramatic information and setting the mood, having Ash take off his hat opens up his face, and since turning back his hat has become a trademark of his battle stance, having no hat also makes him appear just a bit more vulnerable. But the solution to the ghost problem is ghost-repelling sutras. And is anybody getting an Inuyasha's Miroku vibe from this lady? I don't know. I don't expect them to work. But Ash determines that if it helps Brock, it's worth the money. What a good friend. So that night, they stay up in the old temple, waiting for the ghost to come so they can break the spell. They wait late, late into the night, and I'm sure that if Nurse Joy knew about this, she'd be pitching a fit. But the ghost finally does make an appearance. And as expected, those sutra stickers are useless. Brock is still infatuated, and maybe James is as well, but it also appears that he has a fear of ghosts that overrides his ghostly spell. Because while Brock is all, "I love you, ghosty," James is crying and says that he's terrified. And in a conversation with Team Rocket, while he's being pulled in by the ghost's homing beam, he reveals that his mind must be somewhat back to him because he doesn't want to go with the ghost. It surprises the rest of the team. And maybe it's because James isn't as girl crazy as Brock is, that he's able to realize the seriousness of the situation and make the choice to stay, whereas Brock would do just about anything for a girlfriend, possessed or not. And like hypnotism, they say you can't make someone do something against their nature, but if it's in line with things that they'd normally be doing, then it doesn't take much to just tweak the details and have them eating onions they think are apples. And I think we should also point out that Ash is in no way affected by this man-trapping ghost thing. It may be because he's 10, maybe because he's Ash. But everyone rallies to protect their men, Ash, Misty, and Pikachu grabbing Brock and pulling him in, and Jessie grabs a bazooka and stakes her claim on James. James is touched, despite Jessie trying to be all tsundere about it and going off on a slightly feminist rant about hating girls that just wait around for their men like pets. The ghost doesn't like interference and calls up some specters to help her. Ash opens the Pokedex, and it's never a good day when something's coming at you, but the Pokedex claims it's nothing. But Dexter keeps searching and eventually identifies the girl as Ghastly. The weird part is, Ghastly is also the old woman. That explains the sutras not working. Well, if it is a Pokemon, Ash knows exactly what to do. But this Ghastly has perfected its techniques to the point where it can either shapeshift or cast really, really good Zora-level illusions, and Pikachu is now forced to do battle with the mousetrap of his nightmares. Meowth is distracted by a toy, Ekans has to face a mongoose, real animal alert, so Jessie tags off to James and, coughing, does a poison gas attack. The mongoose just gets a gas mask. Charmander has to face a fire extinguisher. BB and Squirtle have to face Venus toys, a Pokemon that probably had a tough time growing up if it were real. They ran through the whole gauntlet here. But wait, doesn't Misty have Pokemon? Misty has decided to take on the supernatural side of the ghostly opponent, showing up with a cross, and garlic, a wooden stake, and a hammer. Here to kill a ghost, not Edward Cullen. But unlike Edward, who sparkles in sunlight, Ghastly can't stand it, and the rising sun of dawn is what saves everyone's hide. Ghastly entreats everyone not to forget the ghost of the maiden and disappears. With the shining light and people's trances finally broken, it looks like it's going to be a good day. Later that evening, Officer Jenny explains to Brock that the people send out candles on little boats off to the sea every year in honor of the ghost of Maiden's Peak, lighting the way for her lost soldier. Ghastly has a conversation with the maiden's ghost, showing that it's not such an evil guy trying to keep alive all the old legends so that the wandering spirits are never forgotten. This is actually a really sweet little scene here between Ghastly and the maiden. I almost wish it had like a spin-off series or something. Like, Ghastly promises that if he ever meets the man she's been searching for, it'll guide him back to the maiden, and it'll return to visit her again at the next festival. Like, this is bittersweet. I love it. Back to Brock. He is still entranced with the maiden, but seems to accept that they're just not meant to be. And we cut to the festivities, where Jessie and James get to handle the music. Also getting into the swing of things are Ash and Misty sporting lovely yukata. And again, Ash doesn't have his hat on. Of course, it would look really weird to wear a baseball cap with yukata, but I think it's fortuitous that he's not wearing it. Like, his face is open and accessible, because when Misty walks in, well, we want to see it properly. And this is the first scene with Misty's hair down as well. Doesn't she look sweet? She's accompanied by the sparkles and the sound effects and the soft focus that implies that whoever's vision we're looking through, they think this is attractive. And unless we're getting Pikachu vision, we can take that to mean that Ash does think she's pretty here. And he doesn't fawn over her like he did back with Giselle, but he is stopped for a moment, and he takes Misty's hand eagerly when they run off to dance. Can I just say, those two are so freaking adorable here. I love a lot about the two of them as a possible little 10-year-old romance. I think they're perfectly sweet in their yukata, and I love how Misty's a little bit taller than Ash and how she takes the lead, and it's kind of, well, it's a pretty Japanese gesture for the man to be all manly and take his girlfriend's hand and kind of pull her along behind him. Like, I guess it's how we Westerners would see a knight on a white horse just sweeping a girl up off her feet. But you see this image a lot in anime and dramas, that the guy isn't looking behind him, but he's clutching onto that precious girl's hand for all he's got and taking a decisive direction. Like that's considered quite romantic, I guess. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, because it's just a second of a shot, but I'm kind of intrigued that it is Misty taking Ash's hand and pulling him along behind her towards the dance floor. Like maybe it says something about where they are in their relationship right now, or where Ash is in his emotional development, because in future episodes, he'll be the one running with the girls being pulled along behind him. Or maybe it's just 2 10-year-olds being adorable. Brock is not seen anywhere in these festal shots, which kind of surprises me, because with all the Nurse Joy and Jenny and girls around in traditional wear, no less, I would have thought he'd bounce back just a little bit quicker. But it seems that the ghost of the maiden has a lasting effect on him, so we don't get to see Brock in a yukata. And he's a bit older, so he might not have worn one anyway. And it's a pity. It seems that as guys get older, they want to look cool and stop wearing yukata to the festival as much, like, and they wear suits to their coming-of-age ceremonies, that sort of thing. Well, girls have absolutely no problem getting dolled up in yukata or a hakama or a kimono for these special events. So guys, out there, don't give it up. We miss you in your traditional clothes. There are plenty of girls who think guys look hot in yukata, so please, continue to wear them as this summer draws to a close. I will be looking for you. And with that, we're going to draw this episode to a close. And if you'd like to comment or get more episodes, please visit us on iTunes at Pikapi or at our blog, pikapipodcast.blogspot.com. We'll see you all next week with... Oh my gosh, really? I can't believe we've been going that long, but guys, it's bye-bye Butterfree. Get your freaking tissues ready. Oh man, didn't we just catch him? Well, be sure to tune in, and we will give our little guy the best send-off we can.
Bye, everybody. We'll see y'all next week. Pikachu. Pikachu! Pikachu!